So, I understand we have quorum on, so I would like to call the meeting to order. We have a number of bills to be heard today. I think first I'd like, since we do have quorum, correct? Representative Thiessen, would you like to move the approval of the March 3rd minutes?
Yes. Get the end of the minute coming up, so that'll be good.
Certainly. All right. All in favor of moving the minutes from the March 3rd?
Aye.
Opposed? Approved. Okay, I think first we have House File 150. Representative Anzell, would you like to go through your bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We need to have somebody move this bill. All right. I'll just move House File 150.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Members, for those of you who don't know, I live in the Chippewa National Forest in rural Itasca County, and I've lived there all my life and have always believed that one of the great things that we as Minnesotans do is we try to provide equal, balanced opportunity for all of the state citizens to enjoy all of the many, many things in our outdoors culture as is possible. And that's what this bill is really all about. House File 150 is about all-terrain vehicles. It's about small game hunting. It's about access. And it's about what I believe are the rights for permanently physically challenged Minnesotans who wish to hunt small game. This bill is not about four-wheel drive trucks. It is not about full-size vehicles that are retrofitted to operate in the woods, whether on trail or off trail. So it's about standard ATVs, the conventional ATV, and the side-by-side ATV. And the bill has four sections. I'll briefly describe each section of the bill. In Section 1, the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources would be required to designate trails for use by the permanently disabled to ride an ATV either along trails or adjacent to trails. The number of trails, the miles of trails, the location of trails would be determined by the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. So that's the first portion of the bill. Section 2 is simply a cross-reference which would duplicate other statutes which would clearly state that a permanently disabled person would have the privilege of hunting small game from an ATV. The third section of the bill allows a permanently physically challenged disabled Minnesotan to operate an ATV pursuant to the other sections of the bill with a gun that is uncased. Now, this is nothing new to this population in Minnesota, because currently this is allowed in special circumstances for special hunts that are done from time to time in the fall, hunts that are sponsored by nonprofit organizations to give a special opportunity for the physically challenged to enjoy the sport of small game hunting. I should mention to the committee that it is particularly disturbing to me, as a person who's lived in the woods all my life, to find individuals who have enjoyed that part of our culture only to lose the opportunity to hunt small game due to accidents, strokes, or other debilitating injuries or accidents. And this bill would give those persons a second opportunity. And lastly, Madam Chair and members, Section 4 of the bill would make the permit for a permanently physically challenged person to have the right to ride and drive and operate an ATV, the permit would be lifetime. Currently, these permits are given by the Department of Natural Resources on a 5-year basis. This would be permanent to make it easier for the physically challenged to get these permits. That is the bill, Madam Chair and members, and I'll stand for questions and hope that I can answer them.
Chair.
Representative Bell.
Thank you. I wonder if Chief Conrad could come up for a moment. Madam Chair, Chief Conrad, thank you for coming up. I just wanted to get refreshed on how a disabled person can have a firearm in a vehicle, and can it be cased or uncased? Can it be loaded? Can it be discharged from the vehicle under the permit? Can you just give us a quick synopsis of that?
Madam Chair, Representative, for the record, Chief Jim Conrad, Division of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Currently, a person who is disabled can obtain a permit to shoot from a motor vehicle. That would allow the shooting from a motor vehicle that is parked and off the roadway. It does not allow the transport of an uncased firearm or the transport of a loaded firearm or shooting from any of the roadways. It would have to be off into a field or into the woods or and in a parked and the ignition must be off in order for those individuals to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Dill.
So now, is that big game and small game, Chief Conrad?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Chief Conrad.
That's correct.
All right. Have their,
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and when they're out in the field and they have shoot from the vehicle, they'd have to have it uncased, apparently, to shoot from a vehicle. And I was just wondering if there's any statistics on accidents based on an uncased firearm and particularly shooting from a vehicle amongst that disabled population. I'm thinking about another bill that's traveling here in the legislature this year, and I'm wondering how that stacks up in terms of safety.
Chief Conrad.
Madam Chair, Representative, to my knowledge, we have not had any accidents related to those disability permits shooting from a motor vehicle.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there other questions? Actually, I do have a couple, but I'm not sure if this one would be best for Deputy Commissioner Meyer or if this would be for you, Chief Conrad. But I just have some questions regarding all-terrain vehicles on bicycle trails. I would like to hear a little bit more about that issue and who you've talked to within the bicycle riding population and if there are any other places or opportunities in law where ATVs can legally ride on a bicycle trail.
Madam Chair, perhaps this might be better answered by Deputy Commissioner Meyer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This would set a precedent. We are concerned about the language in this section of the bill as the other sections as well, but our bicycle trails weren't established or developed to have any kind of buffer like this. along the edge. If you think of just down here on the Gateway Trail, for example, that's basically, there's probably a 4-foot buffer on each side of it, really. By allowing this and identifying these things may prohibit our ability to site new trails as people. It's a delicate process establishing trail systems. The Paul Bunyan Trail System, for example, through your and Representative Purcell's district. If we had to do this or we established a trail and then this was designed or designated as part of it, I don't think people would really be supportive of that at all. Our trail system for ATVs, we think, are well established and are placed with a lot of work and looking at what's out there, but to allow these corridors to be used, to allow an ATV to be used along trails designated under paragraph C, which would be after we're conducting the review of our paved bicycle trails, it becomes problematic. You know, it'd be like us reviewing all the snowmobile trails, Madam Chair, and trying to identify where people should be riding ATVs on those. And that may be perhaps a better area because those are, as you're looking for places to hunt, the snowmobile trail system is through remote areas. It is a place where it's in woods. It's a place where a person would want to hunt. But then again, those trail systems aren't designed for ATV traffic. So it's a problem of design capacity, easement acquisition, and the use that's out there. I think there might be some other ideas to help solve this bill. But for that part of it, establishing those trails within the paved bicycle trail area, we have some concerns about just the language and the precedent it sets. And just real quickly, the other pieces in the bill, though we do understand the concern that Representative Anzels has, we do have some problems with it. There's no definition of what a permanent disability is. There's no processes established. And for us to issue these permits for the lifetime of a person, it just creates problems for us in many more different ways administratively that we need to address in order to do this. So we hope we could work with the author to try to come up with a workable solution. But again, the bill as drafted does present a lot of concerns for the department.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Meyer. I'm wondering if there is anyone else in the audience from the bicycle or, you know, other non-motorized users of these trails that might have anything to say about this particular bill. If not, I do have an additional question for the author. I'm just wondering, was there any, and maybe this was for Deputy Commissioner Meyer as well, but additional costs for changing bicycle trails to allow for ATV traffic with additional shoulders? Was there any other costs involved with this? I'm sorry, if you mentioned it, I missed it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the excellent question. If you look on C line 1.24, 1.25, clearly, this legislation would ask the commissioner to review state trails and to identify any that would accommodate a physically challenged individual in order that that person could hunt small game. Certainly, the Gateway Trail, common sense would tell you, would not be very high on the commissioner's list of trails that would be available for this kind of activity. Clearly, the intent here are trails in the extreme northern Minnesota that are accessible to people. And clearly, only those trails that the commissioner would designate as being permittable for this kind of activity would I expect would be allowed. In terms of the permanent disability definition, I'm somewhat stunned by Deputy Commissioner Meyer's concern that the definition of permanent disabled seems to be good law for a 5-year permit. It should be equally good for a lifetime permit. I'm trying to make light, less cumbersome, less unwieldy for people with challenges. I'm trying to make it possible for physically challenged people to enjoy all of the benefits of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Anzell. And I will just ask one other question because it seems to have been asked in other committees moving along these same directions, and that is just simply, do we have any estimate of the number of people that would be receiving this lifetime permit?
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. I do not know. Anecdotally, I would submit to you that it would be a very, very small number. And I must say for the committee, under no circumstances will I be interested in allowing spearing as well as hunting deer.
Unpaid
thank you, Representative Anzell. Are there any further questions regarding this bill? Representative Hackbox.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was I'm a little confused by the motion and what the motion is. Did we state that it was going to be held over?
For possible inclusion, okay. Yes, thank you.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And did you ask anybody in the audience if they wanted to come forward yet? Or?
I did.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, thank you, Rick.
I was just wondering if, I know Capable Partners, folks from Capable Partners are here. I don't know if they wanted to, did you want to come down at all, Roger, or give your opinion on the bill?
My name is Roger Houck. I live in Little Canada, Minnesota. I've been involved with Capable Partners since the beginning, I guess about 25 years.
Thank you, Mr. Houck. Welcome to committee, and I'm sorry if you didn't understand that I was inviting members to come down and testify. It certainly was not my intention to not have you give your testimony. Thank you.
I had talked to the author on his way in, and we really have no differences of opinion. We support the bill. I guess I have a little problem with the five-year term versus a life term. We have people who do lose some of their physical strength during a period of time. And we watch them very carefully under a supervised program such as we have. But we're not going to see all of these people on a regular basis. I prefer that part of the bill to be looked at again and say, they're probably going to see a physician within a five-year period anyhow. This doesn't create a big problem for us as a lifetime. I think it, not with the DNR, but I think it could create a problem for the DNR, very frankly. But the program will assist our present program and make it more enjoyable for the participants.
Thank you, Mr. Houck.
Thank you.
Are there any additional persons who would like to testify for or against this particular bill before it be laid over for possible inclusion? If not, thank you, Representative Anzell, for your bill, and this will be laid over for possible
thank
inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kelly, if you'd like to come forward. Welcome to committee. Representative Kelly, I will move this bill with the intent that we will hear it today for possible inclusion in the omnibus game and fish bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please explain your bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I believe you also have an amendment there. That will mirror the language that was changed on the Senate side as well.
Representative Kelly, would you like to move this amendment at this time? Sorry, I believe that probably, would you like to recommend this? Representative Murdoch, would you like to move this amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move this forward.
All right. All in favor of adopting this amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like? All say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment adopted. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill is really, a cleanup bill, and it was brought to me by actually a game warden in our district surrounding the issue revolving some of the deer baiting. So we want to tighten the bill, and I also have here, all of you know, Chief Jim Conrad from the DNR Enforcement Division to help explain it as well.
Chief Conrad.
Madam Chair, we have asked Representative Kelly to include this amendment to make things a little less confusing and ambiguous for the Division of Enforcement in their enforcement of it. The original language stated unharvested food resulting or from farming, forest management, etc. One of our problems was the definition of what is unharvested. And so we offered the language for the amendment where we replaced the word unharvested and just used the word food that has not been placed by a person and resulting from normal accepted farming, forest management, whatever. That really tightens it up in that rather than unharvested food that can be picked up and moved to other places, this prohibits the placement of any kind of food resulting from those practices. And it results from a case that actually never went to court but was challenged in a situation where a food plot, some corn was taken from a food plot which was legal and moved to another location under another tree stand. And there was a little bit of a loophole there that was being explored by the individual who was charged with the baiting as a result of that. And there was some indication from the local judiciary that they were going to maybe follow along with that line of thinking. This would remove that ambiguity and make it a lot less difficult for our officers to do their job.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members? Are there any, I guess actually I do have one. I'm going to wait and see if someone else has. And this is for Chief Conrad or for the author of the bill, either one of you, just regarding the bird feeder issue. I don't know if other representatives have been hearing quite as much about this as some of us have, but there seems to be some consternation about bird feeders and people that are wanting to feed their birds. So I'm not sure which of you two would like to address that, but apparently there is some interest with that within people in Minnesota.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll certainly defer to the expert here.
Madam Chair, I wouldn't call myself an expert, but I guess I'm very familiar with the issue. We do not prohibit the feeding of birds. What we don't want people to do is hunt over bird feeders, which basically work in the same manner as a distributor of bait. Obviously, you cannot control what is attracted by the food items that drop out of a bird feeder. And in fact, there are turkey feeders that consist of a 50-gallon drum that you can fill with corn and spread it all over the place, and they're feeding birds. It's just that it's turkeys, and of course the deer are equally attracted to that same food item, and that was one of our issues with the bird feeder exception. We do not have any problems with people feeding birds or other wildlife for that matter. We just don't want them hunting over them.
Thank you. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, probably what would have been better is put the whole bill in just instead of just the definition, because that's what's causing the confusion. Mm-hmm. If the whole baiting bill is here, we would be able to see that it's a placement of the bird feeder out and hunting over it is the problem. It's okay to still feed your birds in your yards and this and that. It's just that the case that we had up in northern Minnesota where a person actually took sunflower seeds, a huge bag, and put them out for deer and said he was feeding the birds. And so this is what that would prohibit.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Hackbar.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And that's what I'm wondering. Where does it say that you're not going to pinch somebody for putting out bird seed in their bird feeder and attracting deer and that sort of thing? I mean, is it just assume that you guys aren't going to do that? Or is there something, is it spelled out somewhere that that's not going to happen? I mean, that's the question, and that's what people are emailing me about, mm-hmm. that they're concerned that that might happen. Are we just to take the department's word that that's not going to happen, or is there something that says that's not going to happen?
Chief Connors.
Representative Cornish, right? Is it somewhere else in statute that we don't see on this particular bill that guarantees the fact that people aren't going to be getting a ticket for putting bird seed out and attracting deer?
Chief Conrad.
Madam Chair, Representative, the violation is hunting over bait. If you are not hunting over those bird feeders or any other item that meets the definition in this bill, you are not going to get arrested.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to follow up on Representative Hackbart's question, so if we have a neighbor in a close proximity to the neighbor next to them has a bird feeder, and you're hunting in your deer stand, and the neighbor has the bird feeder, how close? I mean, it's conceivable. If it was within sight, would that be considered you'd be hunting over that bird feeder?
Chief Conrad.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is addressed in the rest of the statute in that adjacent landowners, and we had this situation where there was a change in the regulations last year to allow an adjacent landowner to feed or bait or whatever they want to do as long as they're not hunting over it, and you cannot affect your neighboring landowner by doing that. In other words, we had some situations up north where there were long, narrow properties where you couldn't get very far from somebody who might be baiting along that property line, and the old law would have precluded you from hunting on your own property because of that. The current law, if the activity is not happening on your property or it isn't happening on somebody else's property with your collusion, there is not a violation as well. So your neighbor could feed the birds and you could hunt on your side of the fence. I would guess that you wouldn't want to be shooting that deer under their feeders, however. But there are no distances that are defined, yes.
Madam Chair,
Representative McNamara.
You clarified it for me. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at this, where it should be placed here, just clarification, so that as we're going on line 11 here, and I'm just wanting to make sure that I understand exactly what you're saying. I really don't have a critter in this fight. I don't. But so on line 11, then it's going to say food that has not been placed by a person and plantings. Am I at the right place?
Chief Conrad.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe it would say food that has not been placed by a person and resulting from normal accepted farming, forest management, wildlife. I think
that's line 10, then.
Right, correct.
Yeah, that'd be line 10.
The amendment says 11.
Representative Purcell.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Unless I'm reading that wrong. See, page 1, line 10, and then page 1, line 11. Two different things going on there, it looks to me like.
Madam Chair, Representative, mine speaks to line 10 in all three So I'm not sure, maybe you have a different copy than we do, or...
Our amendment actually on 1.3 says page 1, line 11. Therein, I think, lies the confusion.
Okay. Madam Chair, I stand corrected here. Apparently, I don't have the... My language is not the same as what this amendment is. Mine refers to line 10 in all three cases.
Right.
So let me look at this one here, please.
Right. Perhaps I could just make an oral amendment that would change this, just to say that it would be page 1, line 10, rather than line 11. And I think, would that put it in the form that you had intended it to be? I believe that's what council has suggested as well.
Yes, Madam Chair.
I'd offer that. Unless there's...
Okay. Representative Purcell would like to make an oral amendment on 1.3 of the A1 amendment, saying that changing the language, saying page 1, comma, line 10, rather than line 11. Okay. All in favor of that oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you, Representative Purcell, for catching that. Are there any other questions or any additional testimony that anyone else has on this particular bill? Seeing none, House File 652, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Representative Hackbarth, if you'd like to move your bill, 1287.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move House File 1287 be held over for possible inclusion in the game of fish bill.
Thank you. To your bill.
Madam Chairman, we heard testimony on this. I had an amendment to Representative Nelson's bill last Monday, and we've heard testimony on this, and I have Mr. Jeff Weaver with me today to answer any questions that you may have. I think it's pretty straightforward what the issue is. About leaving decoys out overnight next to adjacent land that that person may own. Might there be any questions?
Thank you. Are there any questions for the author? If not, are there any questions for the testifier? Representative McNamara.
And this might be for either the Representative Hackbarth may know. Is it the same on opening day, Representative Hackbarth? Is it, would this allow it to be 4 hours before opening day then too?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I don't know
the answer to that
question. I don't think it does. I don't think it does allow it, but I'm not sure. I might have to ask someone from the DNR on that issue. But this would stop the practice from happening altogether. You wouldn't be able to do it anymore. You wouldn't be able to leave them out all night at all anymore.
And it looks, Representative Falk just brought to my attention that the current language would not allow, and that's still in there about 4 hours before. Thank you.
Representative Gill.
Thank you. And Representative Hackbarth, and remind me, this only applies to water, correct? It doesn't apply to field.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Weaver might have a few comments, just brief comments.
Thank you. Mr. Weaver, please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Jeff Weaver, Anoka, Minnesota. This is a very interesting bill. We've seen the consequences of what happens when people are allowed to... It's almost like a loophole in the law because it has unintended consequences, but folks that own land on public water are able to leave out hundreds and hundreds of decoys overnight. And what happens is if the public wants to come down and hunt a reed bed that is close to the vicinity of where these blocks are, you need to put out, especially in late season hunting, very difficult to try to compete, and it really brings the fair chase back into hunting waterfowl, especially late in the season on big water.
Representative Dill.
Maybe I better have Conrad yell down here again.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver.
How big,
Chief Conrad.
Madam Chair. How, Chief Conrad, how big of a water does it have to be public water? And the question is, where I'm going with this is if you have a lake, at some property I own, I have a lake that's totally on my property. Will I, under this bill, would I be able to leave my decoys out? That's my question, because everybody, the previous test buyer said public waters, and I'm good with all of that. But the question is, I think you get the question now. And a friend of mine has about a 600-acre lake that's totally within his farm. And so he'd be real interested in, is that public water or is that his water?
Chief
because
Conrad.
It's totally surrounded.
Excuse me, Chief Conrad.
Madam Chair, Representative, boy, that's a real good one. And we weren't even looking that direction. I applaud you for bringing that up. But yes, public waters can be small enough or big enough in the case of that lake of your friend to be public waters but yet be completely enclosed by private ownership. I would hazard to say that this would prohibit the leaving of decoys out on that particular piece of water as well.
I think that, I'm sure.
Representative Dill.
I think we better get a little more. I'm for what we're doing, but I want to make sure we don't cause another problem as well. And I've never even put a decoy in my pond. I won't hunt over water. It's too much work. But I can see where the problem might become a problem if we make it less this way and take away some people what they perceive at least as their property rights. I mean, we're probably already doing that. But I don't think there's any doubt that public water is public water, except maybe when it's totally surrounded by someone's private land. So, I mean,
yeah.
I just want to kind of get to the bottom of this.
Yes, Chief Conrad, I was just wondering if it would have anything to do with language about public access on a given body of water. But perhaps you can look into that more.
Madam Chair, I think that you could probably craft some language that would exempt those public waters that are completely surrounded by a single ownership or something like that to exclude those particular situations that Representative Dill was speaking to.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Well, to this point, Chief Conrad, thank you, Representative Dill, for bringing that up, because we do hunt a pond that I'm thinking of that is public water, but it is completely surrounded by private property, but also another one of them on the property has an adjoining another private property owner, so it's got two private property owners, and we hunt it together so that if they're hunting it, we don't hunt it. But if we hunt it for a weekend, under current law, we can leave the decoys out overnight unless we're worried about them freezing or blowing away. Isn't that correct, Chief?
Chief Conrad.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. I can see issues where there isn't a single ownership of the surrounding. I mean, if the ownership would change, you have a situation where there's a friendly use of that, but you know, say you have a lake with four owners and one of them wants to put his decoys out and he precludes everybody else then from using that particular body, I can see there'd be some contention there. But you know, a single ownership, yeah, I can see where you might want to make that exception.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Chief Conrad, Madam Chair. We're going to have to do a little work investigation onto that before we get to the end of this. I just don't want to do something that causes, you know, unintended consequences.
Representative,
yeah,
work with you,
Representative. Yeah, okay.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to offer to you, it is unsettled law. It's unsettled law. The state claims ownership to Lake Bitch.
Representative Dill.
All right, and that, but that, I think the interpretation has been that just having the decoy anchored in a lake isn't using the lake bed and taking ownership of it, as I recall the previous discussion. I think it's very murky, kind of like the way the Mississippi looks right now, this whole thing. Is that right, Chief Conrad?
Madam Chair, Conrad. Representative, yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
Are there any further questions of the testifiers, or is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify? There is.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of Fish and Wildlife Alliance. And as I listened to the discussion, I wasn't going to say anything, but I thought that to answer the question that you're asking, wouldn't, number one, that's been deleted, take care of the situation of the private land? To Representative Dill's question?
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, no, that's one of the issues that this bill wants to address, is the private land issue. We don't want to just put that back in the state, back in the language, no.
Okay. Yes.
Are
there any further questions? If not, as I understand it, Representative Hackbarth, you will be working with Representative Dill and others,
yep.
And we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Dill, welcome to committee. If you would like to move your bill.
Move House File 1138 for possible inclusion. And, Madam Chair, the bill, let's talk about the last part of the bill first, which is regarding the trout season. We extended the trout season 2 weeks on the far end from March 15th to March 31st for both lakes inside and outside the boundary waters. There was a real battle cry from constituents that live up there that they want, that their kids are home over the holiday break, and that the people are off work over the holiday break, and that they just lost being able to go trout fishing during the break, because the date was January 15th. And so the bill moves just the season date in the boundary waters, lakes that are totally within the boundary waters, back to January 1st, and leaves the end date at the same time as the lakes that are partially in or totally out of the boundary waters. So it's, the only change here is the first is from January 1 to January 15th, adding that two-week period to the season just for the lakes in the boundary waters. Now, Mr. Bogus is here. You want to come down here, but I gathered from his from our conversation that they don't. It used to be this way, and they don't have any real heartache over it. And they're going to be monitoring. And if we need to make some changes at another time, is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Bogus.
Madam Chair, for the record, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources, and Representative Dill. That's basically correct. It's just a little bit of background for the committee. The season inside the boundary waters for lake trout was expanded back when the wilderness area was created because access was more difficult, and we thought lake trout are a slow-growing, highly sought-after species that can be overfished, but we thought with the reduced access that it would support a longer season. And the bill last year expanded seasons everywhere for lake and stream trout in lakes, and we had some concerns about it, but felt with doing it everywhere, it would spread the pressure, and that we would monitor it and see what happens. Now, this just basically restores the lakes inside the boundary waters to the 1st of January. As Representative Dill said, it leaves the season longer for the lakes outside, so we're going to continue to monitor that. But at this point, we think there's enough lake trout and stream trout lakes up there that are open that hopefully the fishing pressure will be dispersed across all those lakes and that it won't create problems for lake trout populations. So we're fine with it for now. We'll monitor it, and if there's a biological issue, we'll come back and have another discussion.
Representative Dale.
In full disclosure on this, this what I call a technical change, is I did have a call from a DNR employee, not in the, in my region, that said that by opening the sea, right now they both open on the 15th of January, inside and outside, but by opening it on the 1st, inside the boundary waters, that that was going to create a lot of pressure because the people who would be waiting for the 15th for the lakes outside the boundary waters would start going to the lakes inside the boundary waters on the 1st of January. Well, Mr. Bogus and I discussed that, and you got to remember, you're skiing or snowshoeing or walking into those lakes in the boundary waters. So right now I think we're comfortable with it, but I just wanted you to know that I did have one person call me and say that that was going to cause a problem on the resource, and happened to be a DNR employee. So I just want to give that to the committee, and you and I discussed that, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, and Representative Dillon, and it is true that this takes us back to a double opener type situation, which when you have an opener, you tend to get more pressure on that date. Now we're going to have two openers again for Lake Trout, but it's also restoring it to the way it was before when we had two openers. So, like I said earlier, it's the 2 weeks that have been added to the seasons outside that are actually of more concern to us than the openers that inside boundary waters.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Dale. I had thought that perhaps you were going to disclose that you weren't actually going to fish for Lake Trout because it was too much work too.
Well, I've only been on a pair of cross-country skis once, Madam Chair, and that was at the Ely at the ski club, and the first hill almost ended my ski career. And so I haven't done it that. That's the only one time. All right, the second part of the bill is over use of ATVs for bear baiting. And I'm going to have Mr. Potter come down. I'll give you a quick shot at this. In August, if they want to go cross country, it's not legal. But yet you can bait, and a lot of the baiting happens in August. You can go in a managed forest. You can go on forest access trails and roads and marked routes, but you can't go off cross country in August. And in September, they can retrieve big game when they're in possession of a valid license, but they can't go bait. But yet, you can bait. I mean, you certainly can bait for bear during September. And so this causes a problem. I mean, if people don't bait bear on route, they go off trail to bait bear. And this would allow them to do that. And they can do it in October and November and December, I think they can go. I'll have Mr. Potter explain it because it gets kind of complicated.
Thank you. Mr. Potter.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Ron Potter. I'm with Parks and Trails, which is the Department of Natural Resources. To briefly try to explain the off-trail travel exemption, in September, you're allowed to use an ATV to retrieve downed big game. And then in October, that is expanded for not only retrieval, but also for the installation and transporting of stands. So that's basically what's allowed right now in statute.
So,
Representative Dale.
The big game retrieval and placing a stand doesn't get us there. We need to be able to bait with an ATV. That's what happens already. And people are doing it, and they're doing it not operating within the law. And so the purpose of this bill is to change it so that they can do baiting. They're still subject to the no rutting, no causing of corrosion or injuring or damaging or destroying trees and growing crops, etc. All those things would stay in place.
but they would be able during those months to go off trail for bear baiting.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just out of curiosity, could you explain what this, looking at Section 1, it doesn't really specify that you could retrieve big game in October, November, December, but it says you could hunt them with an ATV. Why is this retrieval apply only to September?
Madam Chair, I don't know. That's because of Ms. Potter.
Mr. Potter.
The answer how that got to be that way.
Madam Chair, Representative, the department's tried to reduce the amount of off-trail travel in relation to hunting, and we know that retrieval is one thing that is often necessary with big game. So we've allowed that in September, and with the hunting of big game comes retrieval, and then the other part that was added for October, November, December is the transporting and installing of the stand.
So, Madam Chair, let me just give you a
Representative Gill.
So now you got Representative Powell, and he's got a 250-pound bag of donuts that he's trying to haul into the woods to bait bear with, and he's going to carry that in on his back, and he weighs about 150, or he's going to do it with an ATV. That's what this, you know, that's just an idea. I'll give you an idea. Since he's an avid bear hunter, plus he'd have his crossbow with him too. So, nonetheless, that's what this is about.
Are there additional questions? And so, Mr. Potter, if you're condensing then that with this change, it would actually somehow prevent problems with off-trail ATV use?
Madam Chair, the department does not support expanding the off-trail travel exemption, and we see that this baiting and earlier use as expanding that condition.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this question may be for Mr. Potter, but it could be for the author, Representative Dill. How do we do it again? So if you regularly go to the bait and make a pass to say you're baiting four or five baits, at what point does the going back and forth to the different baits create a trail? And how does the law read again then once you see a trail, other people can use it? Do we run that potential risk?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Potter.
Representative McNamara, early on we had that risk, but through this forest reclassification, we have completed an inventory of all the routes that are in the state forest. So that is our blueprint that we're operating from. So if we encounter a trail like you're talking about where there's continued use, we would check that against our inventory. And if it's not a route that has been assessed through the forest reclassification, then the department would make a conscious effort to either close it or further evaluate it and see if it should be added on as a forest route. But we have our snapshot in time of all the routes that are in the forest. So I think what you're getting at is the way the law is written is that the first person that goes on there is breaking the law. But the second person, if it's an existing route, would not be. But under our current GPS information that we have now, we know how many routes are out there. So if they're going down a route that is not authorized in our current reclassification that we just did, they would all be illegal.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then Mr. Potter, Representative Dill made a point that there's some current law about disturbing and using, I guess for lack of a better term, some common sense about rutting and stuff like that. Do we have in statute kind of defining when a person is supposed to stop and say, whoops, the ruts are so deep or mm-hmm. it's beginning to cause mm-hmm. water in the low spot or how is that? How do the hunters know when to stop?
Mr. Potter.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara. We have that in rule. We have, last fall, we published an ATV hunting brochure, and we tried to emphasize that extensively in that document. It's also in our OHP rules. We, again, emphasize that that criteria about rutting, destroying live vegetation, those conditions that you cannot do when you're traveling off trail.
Madam Chair, I have a question. No. I have a question. Mr. Potter, you can use an ATV to pay fare, correct?
Mr. Potter.
Madam Chair, correct.
And so the only thing that this bill does is allow bear baiting with an ATV when people bear bait, which is at or before the beginning of the season. So when may they use an ATV to bear bait?
Mr. Potter.
Madam Chair, they could use it to bear bait if they're on existing routes or roads. They can't go off trail to bear bait.
So that's kind of, Madam Chair, that's really my argument is that they can go, they can hunt. It says that they can go cross country for big game hunting or transporting or installing a stand. Well, now what is the difference between installing a stand and putting a bait out? And what if you baited at the same time that you installed a stand? You would have done the baiting illegally off cross country, you know, off trail. But yet you could go there to put up a stand in the first place. So I'm not thinking. What I'm thinking is we're not really expanding the types of uses that we can do. We're just expanding the time period that you can do it. So if you put yourself in this place during, let's see, the period of October through December. Let me read this. In October through December, they can go cross-country for big game hunting or transporting or installing a stand when in possession of a big game license. So now Representative Powell goes out with his stand and he has a 200-pound bag of donuts on the back and he gets out there and the CO gives him a ticket because he's baiting with an ATV, but yet he could take the stand to the exact same place. Not that a CO would do that, but I'm just saying that that's where I'm going with this language.
Representative Purcell, I believe you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go revisit Representative McNamara's question there a little bit. In the trails that are open or allowed, ATVs are allowed to go on trails, and they're they're labeled somehow, or you have coordinates on them, and are they marked, physically marked out in the woods there?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Potter.
Yes, the trails are mapped, and they're also signed. So on the ground there would be signs that would identify them as an ATV trail.
Representative Purcell.
Madam Chair, Ms. Potter, all ATV trails that are open at this time are signed.
Madam Chair, Representative
Mr. Potter.
Yes, all trails that are within the state forest or are in the grant and aid system, anything that we consider to be official trails. The Forest Service may have some trails that we don't consider official, but in those cases, those are also signed.
Representative Purcell.
Okay, I'm making notes there. That's not my understanding, but I'm gonna check that out. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dale.
Well, I have to ask a question then about forest access routes. Those, to my knowledge, are not signed. Only the designated trails are signed. Representative Purcell. The forest access routes are not signed, but yet they're on the base map, as I understand it, and they would be eligible to be used on an ATV. Is that correct, Mr. Potter?
Mr. Potter.
Madam Chair, Representative Dale. That is correct. The trails are what's on our map, and signed on the ground. Forced access routes, which are not minimum maintenance roads or forest roads or designated trails. Those are on our inventory, but they will not be on a map.
Representative Purcell.
They are available, though, Madam Chair, thank you. They are available, though, for ATV users?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Potter.
They are available for ATV users in a managed forest, and in a limited forest, you could use them with under the big game exemption.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a person would know that these are open based on, I mean, what they would get a map, and would did they have to have a GPS with UTM, you know, to be able to know where they are and that they're on a legal. I'm trying to get at how we know whether they're legal or not, and we aren't, you know, making new trails as you spoke about earlier.
Mr. Potter.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell. If it's a route that is not a trail or a road and a forced access route that we do not want to see any traffic on, we will gate them or we will sign them closed. And in that case, the big game exemption does not apply to routes that are closed.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Potter, I just have one further question. How successful do you feel, I'm referring to your earlier remarks, how successful do you feel that you were in discouraging the unauthorized use for bear baiting or for other ATV use?
Madam Chair, on discussions with our foresters, where we've had forests that have went through this classification for a couple of years, implementation is done, we feel it's working very well. We've had foresters that were very less than optimistic about just starting into it and have said that they feel that this is working very well. That compliance is very good as long as the public knows and understands what's expected.
Thank you, Mr. Potter. Are there any further questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that would wish to testify for or against this bill? If not, Representative Dill would move to, well, I guess we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion, so he won't be moving anything at this moment.
Okay, I'll just renew my motion for possible inclusion, and then, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1238 and have Mr. Bogus come forward and explain the bill.
Madam Chair and members, again, Ed Bogus from the DNR, and I think I'll work off of the fact sheet that I believe the committee has because there's some of the provisions in the bill that are found in multiple sections, and it'll probably track easier that way. The first two sections deal with some language that passed last year that requires us to set aquaculture fees that recover the cost of administering the issuance of aquaculture licenses and enforcing the provisions of those licenses. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill would just give us authority to set those. And also the other part that passed last year was that those fees need to be based on the acreage of aquaculture operations. Right now there's a $210 fee whether you're licensed in one wetland or 50. So the fees would be indexed to the acreage of wetlands used and would recover the administrative costs of the department and administering those. This bill would allow us to set those fees by publication in the state register without going through the full Chapter 14 rulemaking. Sections 3 through 7 broaden conditions for providing refunds to registrations of off-highway motorcycles, off-road vehicles, snowmobiles, all-terrain vehicles, and watercraft. If the registrant makes an error, current law, the department or an agent makes an error, we will issue those refunds. But if the registrant makes an error, they're kind of stuck with it. So this would actually broaden it to give a 60-day window to correct those errors. Section 8 deals with protected wild animals, and this is just related to the live coyote restrictions that are later in the bill, and would clarify that it restricting the possession and transportation of live coyotes would not change their legal classification from unprotected to protected. Section 9 deals with some obsolete language. It's a technical change that still refers to delivery to county auditors, but we've gone to electronic license systems and have a whole set of vendors now that deal with those. Section 10, we have areas that are called waterfowl feeding and resting areas that are designated through a petition process where motors are either prohibited during the fall waterfowl seasons, or they're restricted to an electric trolling motor of 30 pounds thrust or less. With the advancement of technology, that 30 pound thrust really no longer applies. There's very few electric trolling motors even sold anymore that would fit into that category. There are a variety of electric trolling motors that use 12, 24, 36, 48, or higher volt systems. So we would just like to simplify it to 12 volt system or less as the controlling factor on how big of an electric motor would be allowed. Section 11 is an outgrowth of the process that we've worked on for a couple of years with some of the stakeholders and some of the representatives of local government on trying to protect uses of WMAs from some of the encroachment issues that sometimes limit their use. A number of parts of that have been controversial relating to buffer strips and things like that, but where there was at least some general agreement was on WMAs that meet a minimum threshold size should be exempt from local ordinances that could be passed that would prohibit hunting on those. So you'll see for 160 acres or larger, which is a quarter section, they would be exempt from discharge ordinances. For those between 40 and 160, fine shot, trapping, those types of things would be allowed, but high-powered rifles and slugs would not be. And then under 40 acres, local ordinances could still restrict those uses. Section 12 is really a clarification or you know, conforming law to past practice that on Take a Kid Fishing weekends, right now the 17-year-olds kind of get caught in that as not qualifying to go without a license, but anybody else could that's out there with the youth. So we would just clarify it to be anyone over 16 who's with anyone under 16 doesn't need a license on those weekends. And we have one for summer fishing and one for ice fishing. Section 13 would be a new provision, and actually I know we have some amendment language prepared to deal with broadening, allowing fishing in state parks. We had some initial language in the bill that we've refined a little bit since it was introduced, so we'd like to come back and discuss an amendment to that. But the concept here is to encourage fishing in state parks by allowing people there to basically fish without a license, except if it's a trout situation where a trout stamp's required, or if they're boating around because that water body may go outside the park, then they would need a license. But otherwise, if they're shore fishing or fishing for a species other than a trout or salmon, they wouldn't need a fishing license. We hope that will help recruit more anglers. Section 14 would eliminate the free small game license for under 16 that passed last year and took effect March 1st. We're just concerned about the unintended consequence again of that becoming a barrier to recruitment by youth that may want to go hunting with a friend or a relative, but if they don't have a license, they can't. The intent of it was so that we could gather more data on those hunters, and we're looking at other ways to kind of estimate that, but we think this license could become an unintended barrier. Section 15 is purely a technical fix. There was a couple of words left out for non-resident archery licenses. It allows under 18 and exactly 18, but doesn't have a provision for over 18 for non-resident archery licenses, so that's a technical fix. Section 16-17 relates to just clarifying shelters. Current law refers to fisher dark houses, but by applying it to shelters that are left out there, there's sometimes difficulty interpreting if it's a fish house if no one's in it fishing, and if it's unattended, then by definition no one's in it. So by just licensing shelters or exempting shelters from licensing, it's cleaner to enforce. Section 18 relates to the rulemaking exemption that I talked about at the start. Section 19 relates to shipment of wild animals and makes the requirements the same for residents and non-residents. Even though we know it's been occurring and we don't have a problem with it, under current law you technically cannot ship wild animals to a licensed taxidermist, tanner, or fur buyer. This would make it clear that you can do that, and it would apply the same standard to residents as non-residents, which is why there's a repealer of one section of the statute, that because we're combining them into one. Section 20 would just make it clear that during the muzzleloader season, muzzleloader hunters may only possess a muzzleloading firearm, not a high-powered firearm that would be legal for taking deer during the regular firearm season. The exemptions for the rimfires would still be in place, and it's consistent with how we do the regular firearm deer season. So in other words, a muzzleloader hunter during the muzzleloader season couldn't have a 30-30 or a 30-06 out there. Section 21 is just some clarification on night vision equipment. Current law refers to goggle equipment, and there's various types of night vision equipment. So the big change here would just be to delete the term goggle and just talk about night vision equipment. Section 22 is relates to provisions for special firearm hunting seasons for physically disabled. We were required to do a report to the legislature where one of the barriers was that sometimes a person participating in a special hunt doesn't have the permit to shoot from a stationary motor vehicle. This would allow us to, as we're setting up those hunts, we work with organizations like Capable Partners and others to set up those hunts in rule, and we could put right in the rule that participants could hunt from a stationary motor vehicle without them all individually needing to get that permit. Section 23 prohibits taking and possessing live coyotes. As we've talked with our counterparts in some other states, we've learned that there's a growing market for live coyotes to be shipped to other states for use in hound training and running pens, and so we have a concern about disease moving around the state. There was a problem in the southeast a few years ago, southeast United States, with some coyotes with rabies being transported, and we don't have that strain of rabies here right now, and neither did they, and there are other diseases kind of popping up all the time, so this is based on a concern about transporting diseases around the country. Section 24 is the shelter issue again, and then Section 25 would change the statewide muskie minimum limit from 40 inches to 48, except for lakes in the Twin Cities metro area that are managed for tiger muskies, which is a cross between a muskie and a northern pike, and those don't get as large. The state currently has a 116 waters managed for muskie, and on 55 of those we already have a 48 inch minimum through special or experimental regulations. This was discussed at the round table, and there's a lot of support for this. There's not unanimous support. There's still some people that would like to keep some of those smaller muskies, but generally we've seen good support for this. The other thing this would do is it would put the length limits into rule rather than into statute, which is consistent with most of the, if not all, the rest of the length limits that we have. So the repealers would be the one I referenced earlier on the non-resident piece of transporting by common carrier, because we're combining resident and non-resident into one, and the musk on size limits going from statute into rule, and then the effective date on the residents under age 16 just was being repealed, just to make sure there wasn't any you know, crossover with effective dates with legislation this year and last year. That's the quick overview, Madam Chair.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Bogart. On the common carrier part on the ticket mobilized coyotes, so a person that trapped a coyote could take, deliver it to, let's say, a game farm, just as long as they weren't a common carrier?
Madam Chair and Representative Dill, the common carrier and the live coyote piece are actually two completely separate provisions in this. The under current laws and rules, protected species can't be taken alive and sold or given away or whatever, but unprotected species can be. So the provisions in this bill would say you can't, it would treat coyotes basically like a fox or a raccoon. You can't take it all, you can't take it alive, and it would keep it as an unprotected species in terms of its classification, but it wouldn't allow the transportation, possession, or sale of live coyotes, no matter how you did it.
Representative Dill.
Well, we got a few phone calls today on this one. I didn't. It's a totally emerging issue that I had no idea was out there. Game farms apparently buy or receive in some fashion live coyotes that they then turn loose on their property so that they make trails in the snow, running, obviously, trying to find food for themselves or shelter, so that then they can have people come out and train their hounds on following those routes. So this needs to be worked on a little bit. I understand what the department wants to do, but it would cause a problem in-state, where I think most of your focus is on out-state. Trapping them here and taking them to Nebraska, for example, or vice versa, right? Then bringing them in from another state and possessing them here.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bogus on page 8 in the bottom there, and they're talking about muzzle-loading firearms, and I talked to the chief here, and I thought I understood it here, but haven't we always had kind of two definitions, a regular firearm season and a muzzle-loader season? So by striking that language, I see what you're getting at there, but up in the top when they're talking about those restrictions, even though you've struck that on the bottom and cleared that up so that they can have a bone cracker or a big rifle out in muzzleloading season, you just talk about the firearm season up above, and I thought our licenses still read firearm or muzzleloader, two different options, so I'm just wondering if there'll be some confusion that all of those restrictions only apply to the regular firearm season and not the muzzleloading season too. Do you get what I'm getting at?
Madam Chair and Representative Cornish, I think I understand the question. This is something that Colonel Conrad may want to address too, but it's, you know, I think the language that's being added on line 8.21 is designed to get at that, that it's, you're right, we do have a firearm season, a muzzleloader season, archery season defined in law, and that's why they're saying that a firearm and ammunition authorized for taking big game in that area and during that season may be used if the person has a valid big game license in possession. So I think that's trying to get at your question. You know, if there's a way to make it more clear, we'd certainly be willing to
just something to
look at that.
Mull over, I guess. So, okay, thank you.
Representative Murdoch.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to go back to that Section 23. I was made aware of three game farms in Minnesota, one in Brainerd, one in Motley, and one in southern Minnesota, where these families do make their living training hunting hounds with live coyotes. So I just want to make sure that we don't, you know, put these guys out of business and you know, work this law so they can stay in business. Thank you.
Are there any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bogus.
I see the author
yes.
disappeared. We did have an amendment. I don't know if we were going to try to deal with that tonight or.
Okay. Would it be satisfactory if we added it on to the Game and Fish bill next week when the author is here?
Makes sense to me, Madam Chair.
All right. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? If not, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And what? There's no further business before this committee. The committee is adjourned.